Possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2004 lecture series presents The Impact of Race on Theater and Culture by Woody King Jr., producing director, New York Federal Theater, New York City, on Wednesday, March 3rd at 5 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock Central Time. A reminder, the Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of northern Illinois, effective until 5 o'clock this afternoon. Hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Ford and McLean. Remember, a severe thunderstorm watch means conditions are favorable for severe thunderstorms in and close to the watch area. Keep an eye on the sky for threatening weather conditions and stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest weather information and possible warnings. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm watch in effect for portions of northern Illinois until 5 o'clock this afternoon. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the watch includes Ford and McLean counties. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Did you know that the Centers for Disease Control estimates that about 250,000 Americans, 250 million Americans suffer from bouts of food poisoning, and 5,000 victims die? And I'm going to go back and correct myself once again. It has to be 250,000 Americans suffer from bouts of food poisoning each year. Today is the first Monday of the month, the day we talk about diet and nutrition. And this afternoon, we'll talk about avoiding foodborne illness with University of Illinois Professor of Food Science, Susan Brewer. She's also a registered dietitian. Listeners, you can join us with the telephone call this afternoon. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, should it be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Brewer is a professor of foods and food science in the University of Illinois College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Brewer, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, got off to a little rocky start there. I guess it's a Monday here. 250,000 Americans. That's still a stunning figure, isn't it?
It is. It's a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Figure what your chances end up of being one of those people.
Yeah, that's pretty, you're pretty high risk. Yeah, for foodborne illness. We got a question through the email today for you. And this listener asks this question. I have a hard time figuring out how long I can still eat my leftovers. Is 2 weeks too long? And then there's stuff we bring back in doggy bags. How long would you consider eating something we've brought back in a doggy bag? And maybe you would answer those questions.
Right. Well, leftovers in general are a frequent topic of conversation, even in and around the office where I'm at, because so many people go out for lunch and whatnot. But generally, whether or not a leftover is safe depends on how it's been handled up until the time it became a leftover. That is, how long it's been sitting in the buffet line, if you ate at a buffet, how hot it was when you got it, how long it was held essentially at room temperature before it was refrigerated again, and then what you do with it once you take it out of the refrigerator, what your intention is. That is, are you going to bring it to a boil or what? In most cases, foods that have been fully cooked, soups and things like that, you've killed things in there that would cause you to become ill. The only way that you're going to end up getting ill is if you have managed to reintroduce organisms into the food and then it's been allowed to sit at the wrong temperature for the wrong amount of time. That said, it's pretty easy to reintroduce all sorts of things into the food. Probably the most problematic for leftover type foods, given the fact that they're already cooked and we've already killed what's ever in there, assumingly we've cooked them properly. The most common pathogen to reintroduce would be staph or staph aureus. And the reason for that is that about 50% of American public carries staph as a natural part of the microflora of their hands, of their throat, of their nose. So they're not sick, but they have it on their hands. This is a little demonstration that we frequently do in my food safety class where we all stick our hands on some agar plates and see who grows out green colonies, and then they have to sit on the other side of the room. But Staph aureus causes what's called a foodborne intoxication. Sometimes we call that food poisoning. The organism grows in the food, and it produces a toxic metabolite. So it's not the organism per se that makes you sick. It's the toxin that it manufactures while it's growing in there. That happens over a period of time at the right temperature. Generally, you're talking about warm in the range of 100 to 120, 130 degrees, and for a couple of hours anyway, oftentimes more than that, depending on how many bacteria got introduced into the food product. One of the problems with a number of kinds of foodborne illness type bacteria is that they will grow in the food and you won't know that they're doing that. They don't cause any visible changes. On the other hand, in the case of most leftovers, usually other kinds of organisms that have, you know, landed out of the air, mold, yeast, things like that, in the refrigerator will oftentimes grow faster than the ones that will make you ill. So the result of that is the food usually becomes unacceptable before it becomes unsafe. That is, it gets slimy, it smells funny, before it truly becomes unsafe. Now, you know, obviously that's not always the case, or we wouldn't have the number of cases of foodborne illness that we do in this country. But Staph aureus is one of the more common ones. It causes rather immediate responses because you're eating something that is essentially toxic to your digestive system. Your digestive system's first response is, get that out. This is the situation where, you know, you maybe ate lunch out at some buffet-type place. The food was warm but not really hot. Everybody comes back from lunch, and within 3 hours, they're all down in the ladies' room or the men's room, sick. Usually vomiting is the most common effect. And once all of that poison, toxic stuff is out of there, you feel all right. And so, you know, short-term, real intense, over with fairly rapidly. But that's one of the more common ones simply because it's associated with our hands and our nose and throat and all that kind of thing. Hence, a lot of the public health regulations regarding how food should be handled in establishments where they're cooking for the public or for school lunch or, you know, group food consumption in terms of gloves, hair nets, all those kinds of things. This is one of the things that we sometimes forget at home because we don't think about our own hands and our own kitchens being a source.
It's safe there.
It's the cleanest place in the world, right? So that's one of the problems is reintroduction of something that will make you ill. Now, if you're talking about, there are certain kinds of foods that are particularly prone to problems, and a lot of it has to do with, well, with two things. One, they provide all the nutrients for the bacteria to grow. These are especially foods of animal origin. Now, meat on its interior, like a steak, is sterile, but on the outside, it's not. But ground beef or something like that has been all mixed around, and so any bacteria that were on the outside are now on the inside, that sort of thing. So foods of animal origin, and that would include any kind of meat, poultry, fish, milk products, anything containing eggs. Bacteria love to grow in them because they have all the nutrients that they want. The other things that tend to be problematic in terms of supporting organisms that will cause foodborne illness are things that are extremely dense and have been mixed together out of a lot of things. Potato salad is a good one. Dressing is a good one. Part of the reason for that is they're handled many times. And every time something's handled, chopped on a cutting board, mixed with something else, you have the potential for adding something else into it. Also, many of these food products are mixed together out of things that are already cooked. So then they might be heated, but they may not be cooked thoroughly enough to kill what's in there. In addition to which, and this is a big issue, probably it's a big issue for food service, but we have regulations that cover it. So if our restaurants and so forth are observant of the public health laws, it isn't a huge problem. But there aren't any rules that cover homes, and that has to do with how fast you get something cooled. You need to get it cool as fast as possible. So that old wives' tale about, you know, don't put the dressing in the refrigerator until it's already cool. It'll warm up everything else in the refrigerator. Today's refrigerators are perfectly capable of bringing down the temperature of everything that's in there relatively rapidly. Now, if you loaded it all up with hot turkey stuffing, that would be one thing. But to put a bowl in there that has, you know, maybe a quart in, that's not a problem. And you should get it into the refrigerator as soon as you are done eating or, you know, taking it off the stove or whatever to get the temperature down rapidly, because anything that happens to land in there, get on there, whatever, is going to grow when the temperature is at the proper temperature for pathogenic organisms to grow. And those temperatures, bacteria that are going to make us sick, are the ones that like to grow at body temperature. Generally, we are less likely to get sick from things that prefer cold temperatures, you know, things that would normally be associated maybe with fish. Now, that's not entirely true, but it's the ones that like to grow at body temperature that are going to be the ones that are the problem. So we have this sort of danger zone between 40 degrees Fahrenheit and 140 degrees Fahrenheit. You never want food in that temperature range for any more than 2 hours, inclusively. That's however that happens, whether you buy food at the deli, when you do your grocery shopping, that doesn't mean that you put the groceries in the backseat of the car and make a stop off at the local discount store to pick up a few things and then, you know, continue on your way. It means you take them straight home and get them into a refrigerator. So proper cooling is another issue that we frequently don't think about. It's more of a problem in the summertime because people are, number one, out and about, going to the park, going out on the boat, doing things like that. Also, keeping food cold in the summertime is harder to do. It also applies to if you take your lunch. You know, egg salad's not a great choice.
No. If you're out and about and you want to go on a picnic, maybe make sure that the potato salad or the egg salad is really, really well chilled, or bring something
else. It should be really well chilled, and then it should be packed with one of those freezer-type gel packs, or if you don't have those, you take a couple of milk jugs, fill them up with water, and let them freeze. They'll last a lot longer than ice cubes and not make nearly as much of a mess, but they'll keep things cold for quite a while. Yeah. So, you know, it's just a little bit of forethought in a lot of cases in order to keep something safe. And so when we're talking about, you know, having something left over from a restaurant when you're going home, if you ask them to pack it up, normally they will do that for you. But then just because it's well packed in a little styrofoam container doesn't mean you can, you know, sit it on the windowsill at work by your desk, or which I've seen. it still needs to be refrigerated. And those kinds of things are very simple and I think very common sense kinds of things. Yeah. But that's where the failures are.
Okay. I want to ask you a bunch of questions now. I've got a bunch of questions.
Okay.
Based on all the things that you've just told us. To the refrigerator first, above 40, we get into trouble. So
right.
40 and below would
40
be...
and below. Your refrigerator should be running at 40 or below.
Okay, very good. And, you know, in practical terms for this listener, in terms of, let's say, you make a pot of soup or chili and you have leftovers. Well, if you've got a fair amount of leftovers, would it make sense to break it down into smaller containers and then refrigerate it?
Absolutely. You should break it down into containers that are somewhere between a pint and a quart, no more than about 3 cups in any one single container if we're talking about, you know, Rubbermaid or Tupperware or something like that. Or if we're talking about something that's hard to get into that kind of a container, spread it out into some pans, like some cake pans, so that it's no more than you know, a couple or 3 inches thick. Because the more surface area you have exposed, the more rapidly the heat will dissipate and the food will become cool. So, yes, you need to subdivide it into smaller portions. It's more efficient both for cooling. It's also more efficient for the refrigerator. It doesn't have to work so hard.
Yeah. And then you can put some of those smaller containers in the freezer. And
right, absolutely. And if you decide to do that, just because it's in the freezer doesn't mean you don't want to put, you know, big blocks of, you know, fill up a whole milk jug with chili. You can go in there, you know, 3 or 4 hours later and take the temperature, and it's still going to be really warm. It's dense. It's got a lot of water in it. So, yes, you want to pack it in you know, meal-size servings, 2 or 3 or 4, whatever, and then flatten out those packages as much as you can. You know, if you're using Ziploc bags or whatever, if you're using little Tupperware plastic things, use the flat ones. They're going to be wider and, and longer, but they're going to cool more rapidly because of the exposed surface area.
So get them cooled down in small containers, then make the move to either keeping them in the refrigerator for a reasonable amount of time or moving to the freezer.
Right, right.
Okay. Another question I have, back to the hands and Staph aureus. Those folks that carry that, those of us, who knows, unless you're a student in one of your classes and you make us take the test, we don't know if we're carriers or not. Can hand washing keeping clean?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Hand washing. And hand washing with just soap, whether you use standard hand soap or, you know, the liquid dish soap that you keep by the sink, is essentially just as effective as the antibacterial soaps. And there are some relatively good reasons not to use some of the antibacterial soaps in the long run as far as developing antibiotic-type resistant strains to all of these antibacterial agents. But these soaps will do just as much. A lot of it has to do simply with the friction and the temperature of the water. But what you need to be doing is rubbing your hands with soap and water, hot water, I mean, as warm as is comfortable to stand, for 20 seconds. And 20 seconds is a lot longer than most people think, you know. Set your timer a couple of times or put the timer thing on the microwave and see how long 20 seconds is when you're standing there washing your hands.
I heard somebody suggest saying the alphabet rather slowly might get you
that. That might
seconds.
Be. That might be. Yeah. I have not tried that one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 20 seconds is a long time, especially you know if you're on radio and you have 20 seconds to fill suddenly. 20 seconds is a long time. Let's talk with some listeners, Professor Brewer. If you want to put your headset on, first we're going to talk with a listener on a cell phone in Champaign, line one. Go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon. I just turned in a few minutes ago, so I don't know if you've already touched on this subject or not. Many hospitals are now using no water, no alcohol cleaners like Purell, P-U-R-E-L-L. I also see it in some restaurants that they're using that particular hand cleaner. I only ask the question because even though it may take some of the dirt off, it doesn't do anything under the nails, et cetera, et cetera. So I was wondering if the speaker would comment on that, because I trust since the public health department inspects the various food establishments that they're permitting the use of these hand products. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. That is correct. They're fast and easy. And part of the assumption is that the folks who are working in these various places are also washing their hands very well with soap and water at the appropriate times, like after using the toilet and that sort of thing, that their hands in general are quite clean. What they're doing is moving around from place to place in food and that sort of thing. And they're not, you know, having direct body contact either with their own bodies or with others. If they are, they're wearing gloves. And so those are efficient under those circumstances. But you're right, they don't get under the nails. And if you've ever used them, they also don't make your hands really feel that clean. They still...
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about the idea that in many of the fast food places or takeout, shall we say, establishments, the same people who take a handle money are also, shall we say, handling the food.
Right.
I've
seen that. My understanding of the public health code is that that should not be the case. And I know that in some of the fast food restaurants, the food is actually being handled behind the counter or, you know, back in the back part where the hamburgers are being cooked or whatever, then they're wrapped in paper. And by the time the person who's doing the you know, ringing up the order and making change and so forth, gets a hold of it. Everything's already either wrapped in paper or in cups with lids or whatever, and that they are not having actual direct contact with the food. If they are, my understanding is that they should not be doing that. Unfortunately, one of the, I think, things that sometimes happens is people get the idea that if they wear plastic gloves or rubber gloves, that somehow that sort of thing doesn't make any difference. I have on rubber gloves, therefore everything is clean.
Yeah.
The problem is, I mean, touching money with rubber gloves and then touching food is really not very different than doing it with your hands. It's just one more barrier. So,
yeah,
in most of the, you know, the large food service operations, it's the help in the back who's actually touching the food that's wearing the gloves, possibly those people who are serving from a buffet line, but the ones who are making the change, there's really no reason for their, if they're wearing gloves, it's just for their own peace of mind, because theoretically they should not be touching the food and moving back and forth.
Right. But some takeout places may handle money and then use those, I'm sorry, the only name I know is Purell. And then they go back to preparation. And the public health department in this, in Champaign County, that's permissible?
I don't know for sure about the Champaign County regulations regarding what is or not, you know, isn't required from moving back and forth. In general, moving back and forth is discouraged.
Yeah.
But it's not, shall we say, they're not breaking a health code by doing something like that, by handling money and then using these Purell, no water, you know, hand soaps, et cetera, et cetera.
My assumption is that the Purell, you know, wipes or those sorts of things are permissible for that reason. But I'm not that familiar with the specifics of the health code in Champaign County.
You might call the health district.
Call the health district and ask them.
Okay, well, thank you for your help. I appreciate it.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call this afternoon. Every once in a while, I'll see that. Somebody making change and then even no Purell moving.
Right.
You know, to pick something up that's a food item, and I just go,
Right. Well, I think one of the problems sort of in the defense of the restaurant trade is that the turnover rate for help is very high in the restaurant trade. And even though Illinois requires that you have a certified manager, Illinois sanitation certification, at least one person there who's been through the training program, very often that is not the person who's out there in the front making the bean salad or doing whatever. And given the amount of turnover that they have, keeping those people all trained and up to speed with what you may do and what you may not do, and then having the amount of oversight, the number of pairs of eyes that you need to have to keep track of what's going on all the time is a pretty big challenge. I think anybody who's had children messing around in their own kitchen knows how difficult it is to keep track of all of those things. And when you talk about people who have, you know, they work in the restaurant for a couple, 3 weeks, and then they move on and get a job to somewhere else, and then coming back and forth and that sort of thing. So that I'm sure that there are a number of things that slip through the cracks simply for that reason.
Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we're going to go to a caller on line 4 in Chicago. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have two questions. The first one is about the outbreak of, or the discovery of the, I guess it's the avian bird flu in Texas. And I was wondering, how does that affect our supply and our chickens here in Illinois? I haven't heard much about it outside of seeing it in the newspaper and finding out that various countries have stopped import. And I just haven't heard anything on my local news, so I was a bit concerned.
In terms of whether or not we're going to have chicken or eggs, or
whether or not we should have chicken or eggs.
Generally, the way that FSIS approaches these kinds of things is whenever you have a zoonotic illness, that is a disease that potentially could pass to humans, they isolate it as fast as they possibly can, and there is no movement of the affected species. across the state lines, across the county lines, whatever. And if you may remember a few years back, there was the concern about foot and mouth disease because mm-hmm. it was all over Europe and a number of other places in the country. And the approach to that was we have a enforce a sort of a emergency response plan if we should discover a case of foot and mouth disease in this country. And in Illinois, our response plan was that if they isolated a single case, there would be a 3-mile quarantine zone around that farm, which I kind of got interested in. I live out in the country, and I thought, well, I won't be going to work, and my children won't be going to school if we're in the quarantine zone until they figure out what's going on and take care of, you know, getting rid of all the affected livestock and so forth and so on. So based on that mechanism of responding, I don't know how they're treating it down in the South where they've been concerned with it, but in general that is the way that they do handle those kinds of situations. They simply quarantine and block off the area. Nothing moves in and out for as long as the health officials or the USDA is concerned that there might be any kind of disease transmission possibility, either to livestock or to humans, because obviously the livestock is another issue, but especially when it could pass to humans.
Okay, and then my second question is about barley malt sweetener. I've been looking at it, and according to the nutrition information, it seems to be maybe to have a third of amount of sugar in it per compared to cane sugar. And I was wondering if barley malt sweetener might be a good sweetener for diabetics.
I wouldn't put my money on it. Generally, barley malt, the reason that barley is a grain that contains a lot of starch. Starch is not sweet. And the malting process really allows the grain to partially germinate and manufacture enzymes that break down the starch. And when the starch breaks down, it becomes sugar, and it's sweeter. And so the more degraded the starch is, the sweeter it becomes. Now, as long as we're talking about a starch base, you're producing from that glucose, which is a problem for diabetics. My understanding is that the only sugar that they can tolerate to some degree without having problems is fructose, which is what's in fruit and some fruit juices. But the fact that it's a grain product that's gone through the malting process would make me think that this is probably mostly in the form of glucose, which requires insulin to transport across the cell membrane, and so the answer to that is probably not.
Okay, I guess I just have one more question. You said they can tolerate fructose, but I know in a lot of they're using corn products to make a high fructose
corn syrup.
Yeah, and right. That seems not to be tolerated well. Is it?
It depends on the mixture. Corn syrup is again, it's a grain, so what you get is a. When you break it down, you get a glucose derivative. Now, you can subject it to various enzyme treatments that rearrange the carbon bonds so that what you end up with is fructose. Fructose is sweeter than glucose. Honey is sweeter than sugar. It's high in fructose. You rearrange the carbon bonds. The thing is, with high fructose corn syrup, even high fructose corn syrup is certainly not all fructose, not by a long shot. Still has a fair amount of sort of the standard glucose-type sweetener that's in there, which is not tolerable for, especially for insulin-dependent diabetics. So under the best of circumstances, I wouldn't make the presumption that that would be the case.
Okay. Then it's not recommended or...
I don't think so.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Certainly, if this woman is concerned for herself or a loved one, she should probably seek out
a talk to her doctor or her dietitian that she sees on a regular basis for that sort of thing. But in general, those sorts of things are not recommended for. That's the sort of sweetener that's used in soda pop, regular soda pop, and definitely not on the list.
Right. Let's talk with another listener caller in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hello. I like to use yogurt containers to store food in the freezer, and my mother-in-law insists that we shouldn't store food in yogurt containers. Is there any truth to that?
Well, that's sort of a double-edged sword. It depends on what you're going to do in the way of storing, and then what you're going to do after. Containers are manufactured from, you know, plastic or fiberboard or whatever. They're approved by the FDA for the application to which they're going to be subjected. That is, plastic for yogurt containers is approved for putting yogurt in. It may be approved for some other things, but it may not be approved for some other things. Now, when you're talking about cold temperature storage in general, if it held food once, it can hold food again. It's not going to be a problem. Where you start running into problems is when you start doing things like putting it into the microwave oven and heating it up. Or if you start storing food in it that is extremely dissimilar to the food that came in it. Now, yogurt is a milk-based product. It's slightly acidic. If all of a sudden you decided to, I don't know, store brandy or something in it, which is high in alcohol and that sort of thing, it's very different chemically. Theoretically, some of the compounds from the plastic yogurt container could leach out into the brandy. So in that kind of situation, the answer would be it's not a great idea. Most foods, though, are similar enough that if at cold temperatures, if you keep them at cold temperatures, it's not a problem. It's when you start doing other things, like especially putting them in the microwave oven. That's where the problem's mostly been.
Okay. I thought it was something to do with the bacteria that they use to ferment the yogurt.
Very few kinds of yogurt are actually manufactured with live bacteria. Most of them are set with acid. But even if they have been subjected to live bacterial acidification, if you wash them thoroughly and, you know, put them through the dishwasher, it's going to kill the bacteria.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today is the first Monday of the month, the day we talk about diet and nutrition. This afternoon, we're talking about avoiding foodborne illness, and we're talking about food safety with University of Illinois Professor of Food Science, Susan Brewer. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us with your questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. A question that often comes to mind and often is raised here and in other places. We have a couple of refrigerators downstairs for the staff, and we all take turns cleaning them out. And, you know, it's quite a science fair sometime. But if it's your turn to clean up the fridge and you're looking through and you're trying to do your best job and that kind of thing, well, there are products in there that have different kinds of dates on them. And that's my question here is, we have sell-by dates, best-by dates, use-by dates, do not consume after this date, all these kinds of things. What do these dates mean?
Well, most of the dates that you're going to run into in terms of product dating have to do simply with the quality of the product. A good example would be potato chips. If you look, now they're not refrigerated, but they all have a best if used by date kind of thing on there. If you buy some that are 2 years beyond that date, they're still safe, but they're going to smell kind of odd. They're going to be rancid and oxidized. So it's for the quality aspects of the food product. There are a couple that do have some to the consumer. One is sell-by date. Sell-by date depends on the kind of product, but this is a product that is held in the refrigeration unit at the store. Mm-hmm. The sell-by date is calculated sort of backwards, allowing the consumer to have, you know, 7 to 14 days after the sell-by date, during which time that product would be good. Milk is a good example. And those kinds of dates are primarily so that the consumer knows that it hasn't already been sitting in the cooler for, you know, 3 weeks, and it's only going to last another 2 days once I get it home. Now, is safety an issue? Well, milk is pasteurized, so it should not be an issue. It'll go sour, but it won't make you sick. There are also pack-by dates that will tell you exactly when that product was put into the package so that you can gauge, like, how long you think it's going to last after that. There are pull dates on products also that are refrigerated. Those are for the supermarket because somebody goes out there every morning and goes through everything from the deli case where they sell, or, you know, the bologna and all that sort of thing, refrigeration units and that kind of thing. Go through there and take out everything that has a pull-by date that is that day. Oftentimes what they'll do is they'll go out and they'll look at everything that the pull-by date is day after tomorrow. They'll take it and put it down at the end of the retail case and mark it down to try to get it out of there before they lose all the value of it, because the pull-by date is the date that the manufacturer doesn't want it on the market shelf anymore, either for safety reasons or for quality reasons. So there are several dates that are actually fairly meaningful in terms of spoilage, true spoilage, which is microbiological. But most of these are qualitative. It's like just not going to be crispy. It's not going to smell as good anymore. It, you know, might change color. Things that aren't going to affect the safety at all, but qualitatively they can.
Okay, so if clearly if I brought a product sometime back, it was salmon that had been smoked, and it's in a vacuum pack seal. It says, do not consume after this date. I go, do not consume after
this date. Do not consume after that date.
We're having that, you know.
Right, that's a
week
safety.
Before, but then also, so that's that says don't go there.
Don't go there.
Okay, and then also use by.
Use by.
I would say if the day if the day is passed.
Yes, if the day is passed,
goodbye.
don't goodbye.
And Best Buy.
Best Buy is a quality
thing.
Best Buy is going to be a quality thing. Use by and do not consume after, those kinds of things. Those are generally safety. Those are safety. Don't do it.
Don't go
throw it away. And when I say throw it away, I mean throw it away. Don't put it somewhere that the dog could get it, or don't feed it to the dog. I get these questions every now and then. Dogs, household pets, can frequently get the same kinds of foodborne illness we do, and then they can give them to us.
It's not good for us. It's not good for them.
Right. And
okay. Well, let's talk with some more listeners here. We've got a bunch of folks waiting to talk with us. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi, I just had a quick question on sweeteners in soda pop. And there was some kind of report out of India a little while ago, I thought, that tried to report that that fructose sugars were not metabolized the same way in your body as glucose sugars were. And I'm just curious about that. I mean, should I be looking for soda for my house that uses more glucose cane sugar as a sweetener instead of high fructose corn syrup? Is there a difference between the two? And is there any way that fructose is metabolized easier into fat or anything in the body?
It's metabolized. It is metabolized differently. The difference is that sugars, monosaccharides like glucose, other than fructose, require insulin to help them get from the bloodstream into the body cells. If you don't have enough insulin, or if your insulin receptors aren't working properly, as in both kinds of diabetes, you're not going to be able to get that sugar from the bloodstream into the cells. Therefore, you're going to excrete sugar in the urine and have a variety of other problems that you don't want to have. Fructose doesn't require the same kind of assistance to get into the cells. It doesn't require the same kind of assistance to get out of the gastrointestinal tract either. So it's easier to move it from one place to the other. So it's less of a problem. It's not as though it's no problem, but it's less of a problem. Does it make a difference in terms of soda and things like that? Well, if you're in good health and don't have any underlying sort of disease-type conditions, which your physician would be the one to gauge, essentially we can look at sugar as sugar. If it's metabolizable sugar, it's metabolizable sugar. It's a matter of which pathway it goes through.
So it doesn't matter about whether it's essentially, whether it's more work, more chemical work to metabolize glucose, less chemical work to metabolize fructose. Is that?
No, it does. It doesn't really matter unless, you know, you're diabetic.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So really, no difference.
Okay. Next, we're going to talk with a listener on the toll-free line, line four in Palatine. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about the antibiotics. I don't know if this is. I'm sure you, it's your area, but fed given to cattle and cows. What's your feeling on the with safety with milk? And I know you can buy certain milks that are supposed to be not cows that have had this, and also with the beef in general, the meat, as far as buying organic versus just the usual. I haven't been doing that. I've just been just buying milk and beef, and yet I question sometimes whether that's the best thing to be doing.
Well, as far as milk is concerned, anytime a cow is treated with antibiotics for mastitis or some other infection, each antibiotic has a withdrawal period that is required by law to be observed. Now, the dairy producer has to keep records regarding which cows were treated and when they were withdrawn from the antibiotic. There are teeth in that most dairies, the way that they operate, most farmers who have a herd of dairy cows sell to a co-op. They co-op sends out a truck, picks up the milk, takes the milk to the dairy where all the milk is pooled together. Now, when the truck comes out to pick up his milk, they also take a milk sample and a vial, and on they go, pick up milk from every other farmer along the way that's on their route. Then they take it on to the dairy, and the dairy does an antibiotic test. And if it tests positive, then they go back and test those individual samples.
Oh.
Whichever farmer tests positive just bought the whole load. So there are some pretty serious teeth in there for not observing withdrawal periods. And the withdrawal periods were designed such that the levels of antibiotics have metabolized out of the animal system, because we have humans who are allergic to various antibiotics, and you certainly don't want to get them into your body through the milk. There are other reasons why we don't want to do some of those kinds of things that have to do with developing antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria and things like that. The use of antibiotics has been reduced substantially in the last few years in livestock production, also, I think, in human medicine to some degree, in order to avoid that whole antibiotic resistance bacteria problem. But in the case of treatment of livestock, whether it's cattle or dairy cows or whatever, observation of these withdrawal periods is pretty important if you don't want to have a pretty substantial economic issue on your hands.
Mm-hmm. And with the hormone-fed beef, is that, what are your feelings there?
Well, the hormones are the same in the same category. It depends on which hormones you're talking about. There are a whole variety of them. In the case of lactating dairy cattle, the one that they use is bovine somatotropin to increase milk production. The bovine somatotropin is also produced by the cow. Otherwise, it wouldn't produce milk at all. And the levels that you end up with in the milk are indistinguishable from the levels that you would end up with in a cow that wasn't receiving additional BST. It's metabolized in the process, and so you can't even determine which cow had it and which cow didn't in an aftermath test. You know, if you took milk samples, you wouldn't even know. So, you know, in that regard, I don't really see that it has any, you know, particular implications. There are other growth hormones to increase lean muscle mass and things like that. All of those also have, you know, withdrawal periods and of the same kind of, like we were talking about with the milk. So, you know, I guess it depends on, you know, what you think about those things in livestock production. I think that the USDA and the FDA have a pretty good handle on the safety of the whole issue. If you have other reasons why you object to them, then, you know, certainly you could buy
it. Well, I know in light, just recently they've come out with, they thought that antibiotics might contribute to cancers in some people.
Right.
Overuse, and it who's to know what overuse is, but in light of that, I was wondering with the, eating the animals that have been, whether that could be a problem. But it sounds like you
what I think is the case is that the levels should be below the limits of detection that have been set by the FDA or the USDA, and that's determined by the withdrawal periods and... so that's probably not the major origin. If antibiotics and cancer are indeed somehow linked, that's probably not the major origin of the problem.
Okay. Before we have to wrap up here, we hardly have any time left, and we've got some people that we're not going to be able to talk to this afternoon. Maybe you'd come back on a different day, and we could talk with you about some other issues. But before we go, I want to ask you a couple questions, a couple quick things that you probably get asked about all the time, and that's within the kitchen, the cutting board, sponges and dishcloths.
Okay.
Okay. What's the word?
Okay. The cutting boards are a real problem with cross-contamination. Most people know this already. You cut up raw chicken, put the chicken in the pan in the oven, and then you go cut up the lettuce for the salad, and now you've got chicken juice all over the lettuce because probably you're not cooking it, and it's hard to wash lettuce well enough to get chicken bacteria off of it. So the answer is don't do it. The best way to not do it is to have two separate cutting boards. I've got two. I've got a wooden one that I use for mostly for vegetables and that kind of thing. And then I have one of those, I don't know, some kind of polyacrylic mm-hmm. thing that can go in the dishwasher for cutting up meats. That way I don't get them mixed up. The other thing was sponges and dishcloths. Sponges just are little, you know, bacterial vacation spots. The bacteria can get down in the holes. There's no way to get them out. Most people know that because they smell. You know, if you just stick them in hot soapy water, that's not going to take care of it. Dishcloths, on the other hand, are very thin. The best solution to that is to use a dishcloth for one day and then throw it in the laundry. And ideally, they would be white, and so you can bleach them. And that will take care of many, many problems. And a sponge that's all saturated with all kind of bacteria and nasty things, all you do when you wipe the counters with that is spread it around to many other places.
Yeah, I was reading about that recently, and somebody said some of the cleanest kitchens, like, look the cleanest mm-hmm. when you take a sample mm-hmm. from what's growing on the countertop. You'd be surprised.
Surprised.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Susan Brewer is a registered dietitian. She is professor of foods and food science in the University of Illinois College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Here now with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Another impressive day for soybeans on the Board of Trade. We'll get to those numbers in just a second. First, looking at the wheat pit, the March contract, a high of 385, a low of 373.5, settling 375, down 5.75. May, a high of 395, a low of 382.5, settling 385, down 5.75. July, a high of 396, a low of 385.5, settling 387.5, down 4.75. September, a high of 397.5, a low of 389, settling 390.75, down 4. December wheat, a high of 404.5, a low of 396, settling 398.25, down 4.5. In the corn pit, the nearbys lost a little bit to the deferred contracts today. The March contract, a high of 298.25, a low of 294, settling 296, down a quarter. May, a high of 304.5, a low of $3.5, settling 302.75, down a quarter. July, a high of 307.5, a low of 304, settling 306, up a quarter. September, a high of $3.25, a low of 297.75, settling 299.5, up a half. December, a high of 297, a low of 294, settling 296.5, up 1. March, a high of 297.5, a low of 295, settling 297, up a quarter. July, a high of $3 and low of 298, settling 299.5, up 1.5 on the day. December, a high of 269, a low of 267.5, settling 268.25, up 1.25. March oats, a high of 160, a low of 155, settling 157, up 1. May, a high of 164, a low of 161.5, settling 164, up 1.75 on the day. March soybeans, a high of 963, a low of 944, settling 962.25, up 19.75 on the day. May beans, a high of 958, a low of 938, settling 957.5, up 20. July, high of 945, a low of 925, settling 944.5, up 24.5. September, a high of 826.5, a low of 811, settling 826.25, up 18.25. November, a high of 750, a low of 739, settling 749.75, up 13.75. January, high of 750, a low of 740, settling 748, up 12.5. March, a high of 746, a low of 738, settling 745, up 12 on the day. March soybean meal, a high of 285, a low of 280, settling 283.90, up $4. May, a high of 286.50, a low of 281.30, settling 286.10, up 470. March oil, a high of 34.85, a low of 34.28, settling 34.57, up 38. The May bean contract on the oil side, a high of 34.70, a low of 34.05, settling 34.55, up 52 on the day. So settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where we had an announcement this afternoon that Mexico may open its borders to U.S. beef within 2 weeks, Celeste.
Okay, and looks like that was good news today for the cattle market. Cattle, feeder cattle and live cattle all up today. March feeder cattle, 88.10 the high, 86.70 the low, 88.05 the settlement, that up 155. April, 87.15 the high, 85.85 the low, 87.07 and a half the settlement, that up 157 and a half. May, 88 even the high, 86.80 the low. The final price, 87.97 and a half, that up 140. August, 89.50 the high, 88.15 the low, 89.45 the settlement, that up 130. March, live cattle, 79.90 the high, 78.95 the low, 79.70 the settlement, that up 70. April, 78.02 and a half the high, 77 even the low, 77.80 the settlement, that up 95. June live cattle, 74.02 and a half the high, 73.12 and a half the low, 74 even the settlement, that up 107 and a half. August live cattle, 74.35 the high, 73.65 the low, the settlement 74.30, that up 57 and a half. April lean hog, 62.80 the high, 62.15 the low, 62.30 the settlement, that up 27 and a half. May, 62.22 and a half the high, 61.80 the low, 62.12 and a half the settlement, that up 52 and a half. June, 67.60 the high, 66.90 the low, 67.47 and a half the settlement, that up 87 and a half. July lean hog, 63.65 the high, 62.90 the low, 63.65 the settlement, that up 92 and a half. March bellies, 97.80 the high, 95.75 the low, 97.30 the settlement, that up 135. May bellies, 99.70 the high, 97.75 the low, 99.07 and a half the settlement, that up 122 and a half. The Dow Jones Industrial Average currently up 105 points at 10,688. The NASDAQ is up 23 points at 2053, and the S&P 500 is up 12 points at 1157.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.